You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and it is the 29th of June, 2022. I first want to announce that the first of the month, we're going to have the Tsar Nicholas merchandising out. Same thing that we had the last time. I'll have the link for all that. Some of you already know it, and that's kind of a big deal. And of course, every month, and a lot of stuff's going to be on sale. And a lot of months, every month we're going to add something new, a new symbol or person or whatever, something on our side that that really hasn't been done before, is not easy to find. So I never thought that I would live to see the day that that execrable Supreme Court decision was overturned. Now, ultimately, this is really what Donald Trump's legacy is going to be, because his appointee, as much as they were just vile in the left's rejection of them, are the reason that this was able to happen. And one of the reasons that the regime was so terrified of Donald Trump is because certain people on the court were getting old. That's one of the reasons they tried to stuff the ballot boxes and everything else. But the implications here are absolutely staggering. A lot of states are going to ban the practice outright, and already have. But I think even in the more permissive states, you're going to see restrictions. It won't be as it was. The Supreme Court had no right to address such a question. At the time of the drafting of the document, of course, it wasn't an issue. It was almost never an issue, because it was universally condemned as a vile and evil practice. So it wasn't something that would be discussed at the time. So only, of course, given the sexual revolution of the early 70s, was this absolutely necessary. They could never get it through legislatively at any level. Therefore, they had to do it by fiat. And that's what the Supreme Court was for. It's a ridiculous decision. There's no conceivable way to square that circle. And that has anything to do with privacy is absolutely ridiculous. But this may also change relations between the sexes. Women are going to have to be far more careful who they mate with, because their fail-safe isn't necessarily going to be available. More men are going to have to step up. They're going to have to be even more careful than they already are, because they're now going to be on the hook for child support and now being connected with a woman he just maybe had a one-night stand with. And I'm hoping that practice falls out of existence entirely. Because of the regime's, you know, obsession with sexual harassment and all this, it is dying out. It's largely the creation of pornography in the regime anyway. But some of these things are just going to be chipped away at the root, because these fail-safes now have been removed, and they may not stop at Roe versus Wade. There's also Griswold versus Connecticut, things having to do with, you know, this alleged right to abort a fashion birth control. And then, of course, the big business, which we're already seeing developing, is that the regime is going to start financing transportation to and from states that are more permissive. And there may be an elite-financed underground system of clinics that may be doing that. This is one of the few examples of the separation of the state on the one hand and the regime on the other. The regime has been screaming for abortion since the 50s. As a way to justify and make more palatable the sexual revolution. Now, thanks to Trump's appointees, they have removed themselves, deviated themselves from the regime. So now the left, of course, is going to be on a raging campaign of censorship, of violence. We have to be prepared for this. We cannot sit on the sidelines in this respect. And if we ever get wind in certain states of the illegal practice, it has to be reported very quickly. And what form this is going to take at various at state level, at a minimum, you're going to have restrictions. It's very easy to show an ultrasound and to see an infant, even pretty early on, in the womb, which is why these things are now being banned from Facebook and everything else. You see, I used to have a picture of an aborted baby on my Facebook, and it was removed because this entire thing depends on dishonesty. This is what the left always was. That's what left means. It's an old Roman distinction. Right being the side of rectitude, which is why we use the word right not just to mean a direction, but also an attitude and a political point of view. Left, of course. Well, I mean, the right was a sword hand. This was a hand of direct, honest battle, both literally and metaphorically. The left was the dagger hand. In the Roman world, you shook someone's hand, it meant that your sword hand was empty. But the dagger hand, the left hand, can pull the, as you're shaking someone's hand, can pull a dagger and shove it in the stomach. So over the centuries, left and right came to mean either the crooked way or the right way. Right meaning correct. And the left, from the Glorious Revolution on, that even the sophists for that matter, in the ancient world, has functioned by deceit and fraud. And that's also taken the manipulation of language, using words like fetus rather than infant or baby is just meant to manipulate. And never under any circumstances let anyone attempt to take the high ground by talking about the cliches of rape or incest or danger to life, since that has no bearing whatsoever on the humanity of the baby who has done absolutely nothing wrong. Never leave the field of the status of the infant that's yet to be born with its own separate DNA from the moment of conception, different from both his mother and his father. That has none of that stuff has any bearing on the humanity of the infant. So utilitarian arguments don't really matter. You're killing somebody, and the left, of course, is aware that they're killing somebody. So either you live with cognitive dissonance, or you are and always have been a sociopath. And now, if more, especially white babies, more white babies are being born, finally adoption is back on the table. Now, the reason that so many white families go to India and China, and the host countries hate that, of course, because it's the implication of what that might mean, it's because adopting a white baby is almost impossible. The demand is so high. Waiting lists was 10, 15 years as of a few years ago. So there is no utilitarian argument for abortion. There's no unwanted pregnancies when you have families so desperate for a child that they'll go to India or China, which is a bad idea under the best of circumstances. That poor kid is going to know what he is when he grows up, because race actually matters. And a lot of these countries are trying to ban it because they don't simply trust Americans. And the only reason they're going over there is because getting a white baby at home is pretty much impossible. That's why they'll go into massive debt to go around the planet trying to find anything to adopt. There is no such thing as an unwanted pregnancy. And of course, no matter what the circumstances are, when a woman gives birth, it is extremely difficult to give this baby away. Money doesn't have anything to do with it. State and life has nothing to do with it. There are never mistakes when they come out of the womb. In fact, the joy is usually overwhelming. And when the baby is in, you know, first grade, that mistake will have her artwork all over your refrigerator. No one, unless they are a psychopath, ever regrets this. Ever says, oh, damn, I wish I never had her. only a psychopath would or schizophrenic would have that bizarre reaction. There is no such thing as an unwanted pregnancy, especially given the God, you know, the adoption is so overwhelmingly difficult for couples. This is a godsend to everyone. So, ultimately, this comes down to the sexual revolution. And what I wanted to get into in some depth today is the earlier manifestations of that revolution. It's been a long time since I've talked about art, in this case, painting. But prior to the screen, prior to the 1960s, 1950s, of course, they had movies in, really in the 20s and 30s, but prior to that, it was artwork. It was drawings, it was sketches, it was sculptures. This is what communicated the artistic drive, the artistic impetus. That's natural to human beings. And it wasn't necessarily for mass consumption either. High art is not for mass consumption. But I do want to talk about what it's like to interpret some of this stuff, sexuality and aesthetics. And talking about Degas and Manet, there's something that I've been interested in a long time, but haven't really spoken about. In my book on the Middle Ages, which came out last year, 2 years ago, whenever that was, I have an entire section on the interpretation of medieval work, whether it be in the Gothic era, in the Romanesque era, Celts, iconography, etc. But when you get into modernity, and you get into the early drives of the sexual revolution, E. Michael Jones did a whole thing on Pablo Picasso, and in literature, he did a whole thing on Mary Shelley. In fact, his Monsters from the Id is a very underrated book. And all of this has to do with interpretation. But in our case, a very specific kind of interpretation. Because now we're dealing with revolutionary politics. And the way I go about this, and understanding, you know, where this ideology came from, and it never existed at any other time, has a lot to do with the arts. And I always use the phenomenology, some variant of Hegelianism, in order to understand this stuff. Phenomenology is the study of appearances. The dogmatic approach, that's a technical term, the dogmatic approach is simply to believe that appearances are real. And it's very simplistic. It's a nominalist idea. The opposite of dogma is criticism. And that's what phenomenology is. It's the critical approach because it does not take appearances for granted. When you perceive something, you have an image of something that does not show that that thing actually exists. All that you're aware of is that you have a perception of it. And that's very hard to get around. And that's what phenomenology is. And it's a dialectical approach, which, you know, is Platonic. And, you know, Hegel, I've always thought, was essentially Plato stretched over historical era. You know, the historicizing of Plato's forms. Artwork is the connection of the material world to the form in a very ideal way. That's what it's supposed to do. The form or the idea or the archetype isn't abstract anymore in your mind. Connecting the material world to the archetype is the purpose of art, bringing it out in a way that our normal perception doesn't suggest. But phenomenology is worthwhile in all of these things, whether it be the artwork of the 19th century or 20th century, because it includes both the observer and the thing, the object, as interpenetrated. And it was a 19th century movement, which is no accident. You know, social context and language in the synthesis of observer and the object, the thing observed. So the point of the movement is to correct two things. The dogmatic error, as I say, that objects exist externally from the viewer, the self being just a passive instrument that records their existence. And the equally extreme error, the extreme idealistic error of people like Fichte, that the human mind is a creator of the world. The extreme idealism that argues that objects have absolutely no independent existence, everything is a projection of the ego, the will. This is extremely important for aesthetics and the understanding of artwork. I don't care what the era is. a painting is suited to illustrate this complex interplay of the observer on the one hand, the observed on the other, and of course the underlying reality that connects both, which is something that nominalism and empiricism can't comprehend. So the work of art is neither a subjective projection of the artist, although that may change in the 20th century, nor is it a purely realistic reproduction of something, because then there'd be no purpose. Now, E. Michael Jones' work on Pablo Picasso suggests that this is a subjective projection. But even there, it only works because society was willing to take that seriously. But the result of all this is that painting, any painting, is a graphic description of this synthesis of the self and the other. And that's mediated by the historical and cultural context. That's your first step in really comprehending anything, let alone something as significant as a work of art not meant for a mass audience. But that's not enough, because neither the self nor the other are simple. Because the self is partially constituted through experience, through history, through language. And so the object that you're observing isn't merely there, but seen, it's perceived as part of a broader historical and cultural matrix. So history and language are indispensable elements of understanding anything like this. Everything is situated. It doesn't mean it's relative, but it is relative to context. People like Jean Merleau-Ponty was a great phenomenologist, especially in the artistic realm, argues in his Phenomenology of Perception, came out in 1945, the object perceived goes through a sort of a metamorphosis that translated from perception as a very weak form of knowledge to actual knowledge proper. Knowledge itself is partly based on the refusal to believe that either the self or the object that you're perceiving exists just by itself as a brute given. They condition one another, and there's no getting, and that's beyond history. That's just the nature of perception. And it's also a very Platonic idea. That's why Plato's works are done in a debate form. Or even Aquinas's negative, the synthesis, and then the positive, at least in the Summa Theologica. They condition each other. The object is measured against ideal types or archetypes, themselves derived from experience and historical culture. So the dialectic in its true form is the mutual alteration of both archetype and object as they clarify one another, not only in your own consciousness, but in the social context too. So the object is an aspect of this huge historical context made up, not just, you know, I mean, history includes geography and language, speaking in the most, the broadest sense. And this is what Hegel founded in the first half of the 19th century. The mind creates the concept from experience and language, but it's not merely invented. It is connected with a real archetype. But the archetype, the form, it has to have content. That content, your ability to interpret anything, comes from your situation, your social life, your education, everything that's needed for the functioning of a society. Which means that the form of thought is always being modified by the content. Well, the content is understood in more and more complete ways as the archetype becomes more comprehensive. And this is, at its best, Hegel's concept of history. So let me put it like this. This is from Merleau-Ponty's work I mentioned. He says, "To see is to enter a universe of beings which display themselves, and they would not do this if they could not be hidden behind each other or behind me. In other words, to look at an object is to inhabit it, and from this habitation to grasp all things in terms of the aspect which they present to it. I can therefore see an object insofar as objects form a system or a world, and insofar as each one treats the others around it as spectators of its hidden aspects, and as a guarantee of the permanence of those aspects." And this is just the very beginning in understanding that things like ethnicity and language and culture and tradition not only are important, but they're absolutely critical. There is no existence outside of it. And what he means here is to inhabit, using that term, to inhabit a thing, is to understand it as part of a much larger whole, which ultimately is what a historically conditioned culture is, which is what ethnicity is. Now, this ideology comes from, you know, Hegel and Herder, for the most part, were contemporary. But this hold that we're talking about, this social hold, includes historical context and language and the social biases that come from ethnicity. So anything you're observing is never quite amenable to total explanation. It's our lot that there's always something that can't be rationalized. There's always something left over. So for Hegel, that which is sensuous, physical, becomes a concept, since that's what the mind does with the what appears to be the chaos of sense impressions. It does impose order. But the order is part of the natural order itself. It's not simply concocted. He never accepted that. But that creates an opposition between the archetype and the content. That which is sensed. I mean, the archetype is the matrix of creation. This is joined together in what we call the logos, or the form of everything that exists, the regularity, the law-boundness of it all. But the form never quite, as far as we're concerned, never quite exhausts the content. The content never quite fills out the form. This is what learning is. This is really the core of epistemology. In other words, form and content are always in some kind of opposition. And the historical development of a people is the means of slowly bringing the two to a closer identity. Perfect knowledge, of course, is when they're one in the form and content are one and the same thing. So for our purposes, the object of artwork is similar. The whole point is to display how the content of an object is explicated by its form or the archetype. And in the context, of course, of a society, you can't interpret artwork outside of the social and historical understanding. It's not just there. Now, how the form of an object's being is either congruent with its content or contrasted to beauty in this mentality is when the form and content of a thing are totally congruent. They've become one indivisible thing. Now, I talk that I am working on something concerning the Impressionists, which people talk about all the time. But what they did was they capture realistic objects and their relations as if by chance. One of my favorite examples of this is the Manet's bar at the Folies Bergère in 1882. Very well known. And of course, this is where you're getting into revolutionary politics here. This painting will be in the description. It may be the main artwork for this lecture here online. So a girl working as a barmaid is reflected on what I guess is a mirror. And there's some controversy about that because the angle of the girl is not reflected properly in the mirror. If the viewer is, in fact, the man speaking or flirting with the girl in that picture, then the angles are wrong. But, of course, there can be much more going on. So assuming it's a mirror, which is very important aesthetically, then the angle may be deliberately wrong. In one view, it can be argued that the man talking with some intent to the girl views himself as the center of her attention when, in fact, he is not. The girl in the picture is both attractive and well-dressed, so there's flirting going on without question, since this particular area was known for its prostitution. Of course, it's a French region, French place. But there's no good reason to hold that the girl is just a barmaid. She could just be a prostitute, given this was the, you know, prostitution, like in the French Revolution, is the core of revolution in general. Sexuality is an important part of revolution, since real revolutions have not been without it. The girl's expression here is almost ironic. It's bored, it's alienated. That we are at the center, so to speak, we in quotes, but he is squeezed out to the edge of things. And this may unlock the secret of the whole thing. The man, if he is planning on paying the prostitute for her services, is certainly far and away an unpleasant character, but mostly for her. There's a reason why he has to pay for this. But from her point of view, it's no way to make a living. If this is a proper interpretation of the painting, then the entire setting is false. The angle is deliberately distorted, since this girl would love nothing more than to be away from that stilted life of the middle classes, reflected in that terrible mirror. It is a mirror, all right, but one that doesn't reflect reality as such, but reality as it's seen at the time. It's not merely a matter of physics. The point is that the girl shouldn't be there. And neither should we. Neither should the observer. The entire structure is phony. And this is almost an admission of the lie of the left, so to speak. In this painting, you see oranges. They look too shiny to be real. The dress is fairly upper class for a real prostitute. or unless she was dressed like this by someone else, which is even worse. And the middle-class patrons reflected in the mirror are both strangely distant as well as clearly uninterested. So the entire scene is and meant to be repulsive. It's almost as repulsive as her facial expression. In fact, her expression and anyone in that position, again, there is a connection. Remember when King Louis was murdered in the French Revolution, a prostitute was put on his throne. Archbishop of Paris's throne, I should say. So prostitution has always been important to revolution. But her expression is important here. It's not some innocent face. It definitely has miles on it. One that sees this sort of life, whether it be a barmaid or prostitute or both, as inherently false, as inauthentic, radically destructive, and immoral. Yet, if this is even partially true, then it's a very positive thing, because the work is then a serious attack on the bourgeois attitude of 19th century France. This came out in 1882. Now, if the modern world is supposed to be based on scientific detachment, reason, and some variation of cliché political democracy, then this painting is meant to be its opposite, its mirror image. This may be an anti-revolutionary painting. Prostitution is as much a part of the capitalist order and the ideology of materialism as the oranges there are, or anything that you might buy someplace. The girl is reduced to a cash payment, as the beer bottle you see in the foreground, which, by the way, has the famous Bass Red Triangle, imported from London, by the way. So if this scene is meant to depict the new modern culture, the agora, then this is an attack on it, and a very, very useful one. The virtues of the Greek polis, the aristocratic virtues of any republic, or any political society whatsoever, virtues are nowhere to be found. The only thing you have in this painting is a smug middle class, these middle classes having no clear problem with the dissolution of morals, these female workers. And this is the basic approach. Initially, you see this possibly as part of the almost a pornographic thing. Then you realize that it's an attack on the bourgeois ideology that's already been radicalized and revolutionized in France just a few years before the 20th century. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that the Impressionist movement was critical. It wasn't essentially. People like George Simmel calls this the blasé view of things. It's what modernism and modern materialism starts to do, because materialism, as I mentioned last week, can't make any real essential distinctions among objects. So if the man depicted here is looking for both alcohol on the one hand and sexual experiences on the other, then A, there's no difference between the two in this painting, since they're all both reducible to money anyway, and B, this girl may be experienced in this department, sees him as just another client, and it's no big deal. But the worst part of this is the uninterested middle-class patrons. They're distantly depicted in the mirror, and they're too drunk with their pompous claims of modernity to think that such a lifestyle is even possible. They live in a bubble, just like the regime does today. They may even say in a smug kind of way that since we live in the modern world, and we therefore know things objectively and scientifically, then the only thing that makes sense, she's a sex worker because she wants to be. She's a prostitute because she's chosen this line. Of course, our advanced social institutions and revolutionary materialism would not endure such an affront to capitalist values. But that's how the bourgeois thinks then and now. So the girl, who is clearly alienated and dejected in this painting, is depicted with beer and oranges, all in the same thing. It's accentuated with flowers for this window dressing, where the older medieval sense of virtue has been rejected as barbaric. But of course, the medievals condemned prostitution without question. But on what grounds does the materialist revolutionary ideology condemn it? On no grounds. Because this girl depicted here, her expression shows that there is no moral ground in materialist metaphysics to reject prostitution at all. And her very reason, her very sense of morality, has to come from the phantoms of the Middle Ages, which have been rejected as barbaric. and consider, quote, inevitable. She is just a hunk of matter in motion as the oranges are. It doesn't make any difference. There's no reason why she shouldn't be depicted here as being identical with the material objects around her. They're all just matter after all, and we are nothing but matter. But we are not the man in the mirror. He's on the edge of things, since he's just one tiny example of a huge issue, the reduction of all things to matter. Spirit, in the mind of the bourgeoisie and in that, it's just a prejudice of the Middle Ages, or it's simply redefined away. But of course, we know better. The girl here is upset that we know better, and looks at the critic, not the man depicted, with a dejected and alienated look. This is modernity. This is modernity because it's essentially materialist, and especially in the case of France at the time. It can't distinguish between oranges, beer, and the woman. That's what this painting is. Oranges come from Mother Earth, so do the flowers. If they can be sold, then the woman who also comes from the earth should also be sold. I have this painting put up here on this site. You can see it. I know exactly what I'm talking about. This is the dialectical approach, the phenomenological approach to understanding a work of art. Let me give you one more example. Degas has a lot of paintings devoted to nudity, dancing, and prostitution. Contains a great degree of ideology that many of the anti-bourgeois writers covered in great detail at the time. You know, the Manet painting we just talked about turns out to be pretty anti-bourgeois, maybe for the wrong reasons, but I don't think there's any other way to interpret it. But the main key to all of these sorts of paintings is the ideological world in which they were done. Not just Impressionism as such, but the post-revolutionary, post-Napoleonic France that had, quote, settled down to basic Western European middle-class values, European values as the EU hacks say today. The decadence and the pretense of this worldview serve as the primary interpretive basis for anything done in this era. But the very existence of prostitution then, and its toleration, even though it's uncomfortable, it underscores both the moral hypocrisy and the ethical ambiguity of this era. And not a whole lot has changed since then. France came to commercial modernity only after the overthrow of the monarchy. Prostitution only became a major area of commercial expertise once the morals of the French Revolution had run their course. Decadence, of course, is the result. Neither revolutionary nor conservative. Petronius Arpitre, who was a critic, wrote in 1917, talking about the Degas painting, A Woman Making Her Toilet, not toilet in our English sense of the term, but her entire the ritual of getting ready. 1877, and he says this about it. He says, this is a distinctly degenerate work. Why? Even Degas knows that to represent women in art in any other than an idealized way is a deliberate going counter to the current civilization, away from the animal. It is an ugly composition. It expresses nothing. It is badly drawn. It is ugly in color, and is not even has not even the redeeming feature of technical cleverness. The total result is immoral. Remember, I have both of these paintings right in the description of this talk. Now, while from a different angle, the author of these lines seems kind of realism as provoking the bestial in man, the bestial in the viewer. This is the point of pornography anyway. But this is an idle criticism. Arbiter here is stressing that the civilizational values are about repressing or transfiguring passion, not deliberately provoking it. A man who had this lust provoked may be a very dangerous figure. But this sort of criticism emphasizes the dependent idea of a woman, that she is at the mercy of a sexually aroused man whose animal lust destroys all convention. But the convention is wise, as we all know. It protects women from such bestiality. That's the whole point of civilized life. That's the whole point of virtue and morals in the first place. Women can only be the victim of such lust. The sexual control of women lies at the root of prostitution, but it's not too far from being a dancer or an entertainer. Arbitre speaks of the idealized way of presenting women, largely because a realistic way will serve to provoke the passions that civilization was founded to repress and control. Not repression and controlling is a very good thing, and at its best, it's supposed to be sublimation, not repression. But it's a very conservative argument. And the first picture, the Manet painting, was really an attack on this kind of thing. Most people see this second painting as actually supporting it, which is why it was done in a more or less realistic style. This was, I'm not saying it was the pornography of the era, because you did have some variation of this, but this is an aristocratic version of it. This whole thing centers around the inability of men to control their lusts, which is one of the reasons that abortion was legalized, because this was something that was promoted. So prostitution, in a sense, is a way to cash in on this lust, and for that reason is a problem. So either way, whether the work of art is criticizing it or accepting it, bourgeois society is reducible to the pragmatic values of the free market and capitalism, known for the fact that all objects can be dissolved into a cash value, and ultimately are a cash value. That's true of the body as well, though. Why should the body be accepted? And the female body, as well as the male worker, is reduced to cash. It's only part of the issue. This reductionism destroys the body as being a private possession. It's now the possession of those who possess money. It could be a laborer. It could be a prostitute. It's the same thing. Everything has been reduced to utilitarianism, how much it's worth. The thesis here, that prostitution is an extreme form of the bourgeois market, the free market ideology, one that at least strips away the moral pretension of that decadent middle-class French society near the end of the 19th century. Now, under the older monarchy, whether it existed or not is irrelevant. Prostitution would have been a clear sin outside the strict Catholic moral approach of the French monarchy prior to 1789. But prostitution changes, and lust changes, under middle-class and capitalist values rather than virtue. There is no clear-cut condemnation of prostitution, because you can't deny it. It's part of the normal working of market forces that they've already accepted. Making a moral exception for prostitutes sounds artificial, since the market is seen as the most efficient way to distribute resources, even bodily ones. Moral codes aren't a cover for power. It's a way for people to be protected. Moral codes that understand the nature of passion. And that's the problem in patristic writing. So bourgeois life is parasitic on the older Catholic doctrine and lifestyle, rejecting prostitution more out of discomfort and habit than any really hard and fast moral rules. Now, of course, this is from the French Revolution and revolution in general. And it's responsible for the slow commodification of the female body as well as male labor. Liberation, as E. Michael Jones has told us all, is really a slave to lust. So you have private vice on the one hand, public virtue on the other. And this is a criticism that Degas sought to evoke here. And critics, like Arbiter, is aware of this evil, the margin of society. But he emphasizes again that to depict this realistically is to provoke the very urges that civilization was designed to control. So Degas seems to demand that the viewer realize that this cannot be repressed, but will show themselves anywhere that they can be tolerated. And what better than a revolutionary market system? Now, most of the criticism of Degas is based on the philosophical conception of nudity. You know, nakedness has always been a symbol for the destruction of all pretense. You got a long list of paintings and drawings of Degas, of women bathing or drying up or washing. They're eliminating the symbols of middle-class morality, which is really parasitic to begin with. Once the clothes, the makeup, accessories are taken off, the truth of the matter can finally be seen. The decadent morals of French urban life are now clear, and therefore prostitution is a normal part of life. Now, whether you like this or don't like this, the revolutionary system created it. So the nude is a powerful symbol of deconstruction. Clothing and makeup are the symbols of how a culture seeks to paper over its vices. Vices that almost everyone is aware of and almost always participates in, maybe only voyeuristically, but the nudity is a realistic motif. It's meant to destroy all appearances, all excuses. It's an existential attack on what a decadent society is trying to cover up, because no one wants to admit that they're decadent. You know, Degas is problematic for this reason. Degas lived self-consciously in the margins of society. his own class background. He comes from an aristocratic lineage. However, that turned out to be a lie. His father and brothers were bourgeois bankers and wine merchants. This is not a shock. They adopted the lifestyle of the royal era, partially for the benefits it may bring. So the man was raised in a very ambiguous world. So Degas, even in spite of himself, sought to destroy the pretenses of morality in late 19th century France, because it wasn't real. You know, there is this painful realism here, and the nudes of the era, and the revolutionary era. The entire point of this real, these realistic figures, even if covered over in the brushstrokes of the Impressionist, is to force the viewer into a world that they thought they could ignore. They can't ignore it, not only because it's there, but because it involves the most respectable members of society. Also because it victimizes people. And that's the case whether it be pornography today or this kind of painting yesterday. And the men are not depicted as victimized, although it's implied that they're at a brothel because they have no control over their lusts. The men in some of Degas' work, they're often fully clothed, wearing symbolically the frock coats of respectable society. Now the women, on the other hand, seemingly without embarrassment or pain, are parading themselves for the respectable middle-class types. The body has a price. And one of the things that E. Michael Jones said about the Cubist style of Picasso was this was the symbolic ripping apart of the female and even selling her parts, her erogenous zones, as a symbolic form of human sacrifice. Even Freud said lust and death are very close to one another. They're trying to get to what all revolutionaries like to talk about as the state of nature, a device in early modern political theory that sought to place human beings in their so-called natural state, a state before law, morality, or government. Of course, this never existed. You know, writers like Hobbes or Rousseau built their whole revolutionary ideas from here. Modernity is based on it. The nude female, for a lot of you know, the way that this is should be approached, it's about amorality. What is underneath the revolutionary rhetoric of the left? A state of nature without law or morality shows men lusting after these women, acting no differently in these paintings than they would in the wild. So the state of nature idea can be found in Degas' nudes because the nudity is meant to show humanity prior, or at least against, the convention that developed after civilized life had begun. Man is tempted by the woman, then brought down by his own lust. The respectability of those who have been tempted in this life, as far as anyone knows, remained intact. Doesn't seem to change them. The prostitute has no respectability to lose, so the exchange seems to be a win-win. But the two contracting parties are clearly unequal. The work of Degas is meant to shock, to provoke feeling rather than evoke meaning. Again, part of the revolutionary ideology. The purpose is part of the basic element of what we call deconstruction. That takes the appearances of genteel society and exposes their underbelly. Remember, we're still talking about a revolutionary system, whether it be then or now. The Middle Ages, of course, had moral problems, as has every society. But they were aware of it, and they were fought constantly. What's happening here is that these artists, whether it be for good or bad reasons, show that the lie of this middle-class morality can be proven by exposing these kind of things in these kind of paintings. What the female figure means, what the brothel means, what approaching a prostitute at a bar means, and the fact that it's normal, but it's revolutionary in the best possible sense, because it tears away the veil of respectability and convention to expose the reality, the violence, the sexuality, the domination that lies at its root. And this is something we do all the time. The French Revolution, a few generations earlier, was a very sexualized one, where the position of woman as the object of pre-civilizational lust was prominent. There was one person in the Bastille, and that was the Marquis de Sade. So we stress how civilization and the art that it creates is meant to bring out the best in man, virtue and care, and the intellect. But especially for women, the feminine should be idealized, because absent that, woman is then a target for lust. Civilization, the ethic state, seeks to protect women from that eternal drive of men. And it's perfectly legitimate. That's part of what the ascetic life is. So to exhibit this kind of thing in public does the women involved no favors. And people criticizing it, and even the mentality behind these paintings, may be pre-revolutionary. That order where such manifestations of sexuality would be considered immoral, largely because of what it does to those who see such works. Everyone's victimized. The man controlled by his passions, and the woman used as a tool to that end. It's a lose-lose contract. The decadent moral code of the revolutionary order, then and now, justifies the female body as the main source of exchange value. Women can take advantage of this, and this is where abortion comes in. The body is then commodified, it is then dissolved into a money payment. But this is the problem. The market can't tell the difference between a commodity or a human body, or it just commodifies the human body. The body can just as easily be reduced to monetary value, even life itself. The market mentality of this time in France can't even justify it. So the concept of the female in this kind of revolutionary, or either counter-revolutionary or revolutionary art, is A, either justifying or at least exposing the problems of the sexual revolution at the time, you know, this gradual release of the male drive. B, that this stuff is all being reduced to a money payment, that this is what the market really is. Or C, it's justified in the moral chaos of post-revolutionary France. So the female body becomes a commodity. At the same time, modern French social morality is insufficiently clear to destroy or to sublimate the natural urges of men. In every account here, these brothels are depicted as illicit but tolerated. They serve as a means of relieving the lust that all men seem to have, and a lust that has been, quote, liberated by the killing of the king, the very center of moral life. So the existence of the brothel isn't challenged, or at least by Degas, though depicted in Degas's painting. The market does reach the human form. This is the key. The state or any institution can try to ban or control such markets, but they'll just reform themselves elsewhere. But you have to have an immoral society to begin with. Prior to our era, society was not sexualized. Young men were unaware of the female figure, since it wasn't paraded anywhere. Now, in the revolutionary world, slowly you're starting to see this in the artistic world. You didn't prior to the modern era. There was no such thing as co-education. Unmarried men and women did not intermingle. That was absolutely not permitted. The modern revolution, of course, was to break those things down. Peter the Great did that in Russia. But this is an attack on the market, because the market is as revolutionary as the commune is. Money destroys what is unique in things, since all objects have money as their sole measure of value in a revolutionary society. The female body, therefore, becomes no different than anything else sold. So even in works in 1895, is after the bath, shows a nude woman back to the viewer. The position is awkward. We're essentially a voyeur in this issue. It's certainly male, of course, since the male would most be the one most likely to seek this kind of entertainment. Now, in this particular painting, the woman is not a prostitute, but there really isn't much of a difference here. The point is that the female body is always an object for attention, and given the life in late 19th century France, it's rarely a constructive or idealized attention. Again, it's reduced to market exchanges. So interpreting these paintings, all very similar, it's almost as if it's justifying the voyeur making his point of view the subject of art, really. There's a private nature, too, of this pose, a woman acting without any social context, since she's, you know, presumably alone. She could be seen in her own element, the private, without having to perform for anybody. In this case, however, she's performing whether she likes it or not. Remember, we're talking about an era that really didn't have regular pictures or screens or anything like this. This was how these kind of issues were communicated. So the critique of this kind of thing, with a positive, remember, a critique doesn't have to be negative. It can be also positive. Nudity, whether revolutionary or counter-revolutionary, is a symbol for the tearing off of the clothing of social life. That's the point of Degas, to show French society at its worst. Monetary value and what that would mean. But of course, both men and women were reduced to the market and the cash payment because whether it be labor on the one hand or prostitution on the other, it's pretty much the same thing. This is what the revolution meant. So exploitation was everywhere. Men were commodified in the exact same way, though for a different set of reasons. I mean, we assume, of course, that an owner of these brothels or these bars, anyone, any pornographer, uses the manipulation of man's lust for the sake of profit. The social collateral damage, though, is overwhelming. Think of alcohol. What's the collateral damage of alcohol? That's why you have to talk about the entire context of this stuff. Public morality, its basic rules are often rejected in the private sphere. And it might be that these painters are talking about the private sphere as it lives by different rules, or that it permits the cathartic release, but the public personality doesn't, or even that the public sphere is just a ruse, a way to justify and paper over the problems of and the sins of private life. The public persona serves to put some limit on the private one. These are all private personae, not public ones. Now, the Greek polis was strictly a public matter. And this is the key to the entire thing. Writers like Merleau-Ponty gives us a means of grasping a work of art that goes beyond the two extremes of bad philosophy, either naive empiricism on the one hand or subjective idealism on the other. Now, I'm talking about this because of the sexual revolutionary system that hopefully we're seeing some damage done to. That's what got me interested in this topic recently. But a painting is an object like any other, as is the subject. Neither the artist nor the thing that he is depicting. Neither one are abstract givens. But the work of art is a very specific synthesis of both. It's the meeting point of a historically situated artist bringing the subject depicted under an ideal, under an archetype. But this archetype is an historically constituted reality that contains much of the truth, but can never completely contain it. It can never completely contain all that the object truly is. In other words, any object has infinite content given the history and ideology attached to it and its context. Of course, our knowledge is going to fill gaps, but this is always going to remain. There's always a residual. Art is a matter of knowledge. Merleau-Ponty shows us the limitations of perspective, as does these revolutionary or counter-revolutionary paintings. I'm not coming down on one way or another. But the contemporary knows things because they're being lived. But it has its own problems. There's really no critical distance. The modern historian, knowing about whether it be the policies of Peter the Great or revolutionary France, their consequences, social context, and ideologies, is certainly better than someone living at the time, at least in terms of the facts. We know more than we did then. We also have critical distance. That means both are worthwhile. Revolution can be painted and depicted as it was known at the time. Knowing the language, the contemporary usage, someone at the time was immersed in the society ruled by the revolution. A modern historian can bring more information to bear, but maybe less insight. But both perspectives are necessary. These are either revolutionary or counter-revolutionary paintings. They depict the beginnings, the first rumblings of the sexual revolution and their foundation in what we call capitalism or the free market. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.